Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Fourth Age. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this time is Virginia.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be back, as always. With us also this episode, we have Carrie.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be back, and Spencer is also with us tonight.
Hello, everyone. We have a great show tonight, and also joining us is Daniel.
Thanks, everyone. Looking forward to joining you for my second real episode.
Good news, everyone! There's spoilers!
Amazingly significant event which takes place that we have almost entirely failed to discuss so far. This, of course, is Matt, Tom, and Noel, a.k.a. Jane, going into the Tower of Genji to rescue Moraine. So this podcast will be dedicated to discussing that particular episode.
Primarily, anyway.
Yeah, we'll of course deviate from time to time, but you know, that is the bulk of what we are planning to discuss.
So I guess as a first question, are you surprised where this came in the novel? I expected it to be earlier in the story, especially with Matt's story coming as it did, or beginning as it did, so close to the start. I kept on reading and going, when are we going to hit this? It was the thing that was sort of prophesied, at least by the front cover art. And it was surprising that it came so late to me.
I was really freaking out that we weren't going to get it. I'm like, no, it's going to happen. But I was like, oh, no, there's only a few pages left.
With it being mentioned so early, too, because, I mean, Matt almost immediately mentions, you know, going to the tower.
Right.
And so it was like, well, since it got mentioned so late, maybe... since Matt mentioned it so early, it was something that I kind of thought to myself, well, maybe what they're going to do is that they'll go into the tower, and then it'll go back and forth. It'll be episodic, you know, and it'll leave off on a minor tangent where you're like, oh, is it going to be? No, shoot. And, you know, and then we get, like, chapters after chapters, only interspersed with what everybody else is doing while Matt is lost in the tower.
And in some way, I guess
totally
that sort of... Right, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it totally didn't turn out that way, which was, like I said, just a little surprising, but at the same time, it kept that every Matt chapter was, okay, are they going to get past the next little hurdle and get themselves to the tower or not?
And I guess that played well with Viren's letter and his agreement to that, because I sort of felt like we were in Matt's shoes, right? We were sort of feeling that frustration of, I still have to wait, right? It prolonged the question at some point of whether he was going to open the letter and follow the discussion, or the directions, rather, that Viren had left him. And you know, you had that feel. But then it was very, to me, this felt very, and I know Brandon hasn't really talked about what part is his and what part's RJ's, but it's felt... very RJ. It felt very hurry up and, you know, well, not hurry up and wait. It felt very sort of long delay and then very speedily through that section.
Yeah.
It was a part of the book that moved fastest for me.
Yeah. I don't remember which signing release it was. I think it might have been Sacramento.
Yeah.
Where Brandon was talking to someone. Wow. But Brandon was talking to someone who was coming up to get something signed, and he said something about, I'm sorry for the cliffhanger, which, you know, now that we've read the book, I know what he was talking about, but at the time I was like, cliffhanger? What cliffhanger? Oh no.
Oh, yeah.
And so when Matt's chapters kept not going to the Tower of Genji, I was like, he didn't. Okay, obviously the scene on the cover has to be in the book someplace. So is that going to be the last paragraph? They draw the triangle and go in, and then the book ends?
No.
No, but close.
Really close.
It almost was, but not quite.
Left it to the last minute almost, so I was really getting worried too.
Yeah. I skipped ahead. Like, I didn't... I've never done that. I never do that. I hate spoilers. But I just kind of flipped the pages towards the back to see if I could see that they were in the tower, and then I saw that, and I was like, oh, okay, I feel better. I can finish.
I confess I did the same thing. I flipped through the back until I saw a spot where it said Moraine said, and I went, okay, great, she's out.
Yeah,
we got her.
Yeah.
And then I was able to go back and read in peace. I couldn't even stand it. I thought, three quarters of the way through the book and no Tower of Genji, just talk about it. I did think that his little interview with Brigitte, you know, regarding the tower was kind of endearing. It's kind of cute.
Yeah, that was.
Well, and there was just a kind of a sense where, you know, he's like, well, how did you get out?
How'd you get out?
She's like, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the supplementary story. Well, how does anyone know the story then?
I know.
Brigitte's like, well, maybe. Maybe one of the Aes Sedai asked. They seemed to... I mean, everyone knew I went in, so... You know, maybe they just got curious and used one of their questions to ask.
Yeah, that was sort of a... that. For some reason, it really reminded me of that moment in Pirates of the Caribbean where Captain Jack Sparrow is saying, well, if nobody survived, how does anybody know what happened, you know? And it's like, oh, I could just see Matt. I mean, they're sort of similar
sea
turtles, you know, jaunty personalities, you know?
Yeah.
Irreverent.
Well, and you know, I love the part of the story when we actually, you know, hear the bit from Tom later on of what the story has become, that she died just on the other side of the hedge from the Fountain of Life.
Right.
And, you know,
right,
that kind of and that kind of addition to the story, you know, had to come from the Finn, because no one else would know. Oh yeah, yeah. Just on the other side of the wall is the.
I always
chamber of the room to wherever you're supposed to be.
I didn't think anybody. I guess they did. I never thought of that. I just thought that it was like people romanticized it, you know, as a love story, and they just kind of thinking up their own things and guessing what happened.
But something like that, something like that, well, it might have occurred, would not have occurred in a Robert Jordan novel unless it meant something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
I actually can't imagine an Aes Sedai going in through one of the doorways of the tower and actually using a question to find out what happened to Jathari Moondancer. Don't think so.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody else would have seemed odd.
Maybe
to
a
me.
Bard who was, or an Ogier like Loyal who was following them around to write their story.
I wonder if an Ogier's ever been into the Tower of Finland.
Yeah,
at all.
Could an Ogier go through the gateway?
I don't know. Do they feed off the emotions of Ogier the same way they do humans? Interesting question.
Well, I mean, considering. Because I don't remember if I'm remembering this properly or not. I know the Nim were constructs of the One Power.
Yeah.
I didn't remember if the Ogier were too or not.
I don't think they are. I think it's in the Big White Book that they're not, but I could be wrong. I need to look it up. I don't have it handy.
Yeah.
I could probably go get it.
A code according to your own lore.
But then you'll have to
from another world.
Yeah. But if I go get the Big White Book, you'll have to spend the next hour restraining me from gasping and gagging over the illustrations involved.
No, I think we can safely just conclude that if someone in the listening audience knows the answer to this particular question, feel free to email or message us or anything that, you know, gives us the correct answer. And, of course, we will give you our full credit following the... following the receipt of such knowledge. Otherwise, if we find out on our own, we'll take the credit for ourselves.
That's right.
This is kind of
and we saw our favorite in the diverting from the Tower of Genji here for a minute. We saw our favorite message delivery system finally used a letter dropped through a small gateway, which always makes me think of the tissue box going through the Stargate in SG-1. I'm sorry. Send more tissues.
Now, here's an interesting question. Unfortunately, my book is not in front of me for me to actually know. Does anyone actually remember the name of that Ashimon?
Which one?
The male boy.
Oh, no. The Ashimon, I can remember a knife and a knife and Andral and there were a few others.
Was it Cliff Clavin?
Actually, yeah. Hold on a second. I will. I realize I don't have my book to hand, and I really should have that. So I will return in just a moment.
I don't really remember where that was in the book. To be honest with you, I mentioned it, but I didn't. I don't remember where it was. Was that the note to Gawain that came through Gateway? Was that Sylviana's letter to Gawain?
That I'm trying to think.
That came through the Gateway.
Working with leather is the chapter title.
That's the gateway drop? The mail drop?
Well, that's the one where we are introduced to the character.
Was it the letter to Gawain from that Sylviana sent that was dropped through the gateway?
Well, there is that one. She uses it, but there's an Ashimon who also did it. Because, I mean, he also was using it to cut leather straps and stuff.
The
Gateway Ashimon.
That's right.
What's
his name?
But he had a nickname, which was basically like postmaster or mailboy or something.
Page boy. Page
I told
boy.
You it was Cliff Clavin. I don't know why you guys won't believe me. It was Cliff
Clavin. Not Cliff Clavin. It's not Cliff.
Sorry, I'm a Bostonian. I got to make the Cheers reference.
Come on,
The thing is it was his last name that had gotten my attention. And I don't know now. Let me just... Maybe he's in... No, of course he's not in the glossary. That would make sense.
Working Leather is 46.
Yeah, I just got there. His first name is Andral. But I know somewhere along the line they mentioned his last name.
I
found it amazingly particular because I thought his last name began with a G. And I was thinking, maybe I got in on the...
That would be cool. Did you ask Brandon when you saw him?
No, because I hadn't gotten there yet.
Basically,
Ganhold. I think Ganhold is his last name.
Yeah.
Andral Ganhold.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Might have been. I don't know. I have no proof, and I'd have to either ask Brandon or go back through lots of posts that I, haven't seen.
All right, if Andral Ganhold is the character's full name, I don't think he's named after you because we see him first in Winter's Heart.
Oh, that's true. Never mind then.
We saw him in Winter's Heart?
Wow, yes, we did.
You know what? Square fellow with heavy eyebrows. Yes, indeed. Okay, well, question is answered.
I remember about him. They were talking about him with the power, weren't they?
Yeah, he was just really good at gateways. And in this one, they've talked about him doing just enough, like being able to manage a gateway small enough to stick a letter through.
Yeah.
And that's how he got the name, Page Boy.
Right. Well, he made one small enough to slice through the leather.
Well, yes.
That he was working on because somebody stole his shears.
Or
borrowed them. Yeah, that's interesting. What Brandon said to me when I asked him about it, because evidently Jason Jennifer knew that my name was in there, but I hadn't heard that because I don't always catch all the posts on Facebook and Twitter. But he said, because I asked Brandon about it, he said, let me think. He said, did I mention it? Did I mention it on Facebook? I said, I don't know. I said, some people told me they saw it, but I didn't see it. And he said, tell me the name again. I said, yeah. Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's it. That's it. So I'm like, okay. But he really didn't remember. I'm like, well, I can't understand why not. He only had like 9,000 other things going on in his brain. But evidently, like I said, apparently Jason and Jennifer knew, so I don't know. I'm claiming it anyway. Brandon said it was, so I'm going with that.
There's an interesting.
Not gonna let him take it back. Sorry.
There's an interesting thing just off of the side now that, again, still away from the Tower of Genji.
Yeah.
we have the best of intentions. No.
We don't have the best of intentions?
Well, no, we do, but...
We do.
No, I was going to say, I wonder if then, for some reason, the Dream Spike wasn't active yet.
No, at that
because
point in time...
Because
it wasn't. No.
He made a
no,
gateway
right.
to slice through the leather.
Yeah. No, it wasn't no. until later because...
Because they were talking, because he was explaining how no matter what they do, they can't make gateways. They could do anything else but not make gateways.
Right. It just sort of happened, and... It happened in between the time when he and some of the other Ashaman that were loyal to Logain were trying to figure out how they could contact him, and they decided to go see the Aes Sedai, and the Aes Sedai had just decided, Tavara had just decided that Tarna was all weird and probably,
Dark
you know,
friendly.
Turned by the 13, yeah, 13-13. And
yay! A new Wheel of Time verb, dark-friended.
Yeah. He was
Can you do that on Facebook? Can I dark friend you on Facebook?
I dark friended on Facebook.
Facebook? What would be the proper?
Yeah, we'll just call it
Faceless,
the dark book.
The eyeless book, I guess. It's the eyeless. The fade book. There we go.
Fade book.
Fadebook.com, where you can be dark friended.
Yes.
You need to go register that right now, Andrew. You know, he originally designed Facebook to try and get dates.
What did you think about the whole Matt and Elaine interaction? The letter to her, the whole sort of, you know, that I thought that whole piece was very funny.
Typical
Matt.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought that was hilarious, especially when you contrast that with the elaborate aliases and backstories. You know, suddenly we know how well Matt can write, and it's not very, apparently, so...
No, it's not. I mean, and the thing is why would Matt have need to know how to write, you know?
Yeah.
He was growing up as a farmer, and, not just a farmer, but, like, you know, possibly a horse trader, but you don't really have to write anything. I mean,
I'm... Well, you don't have to spell very well, anyway.
in one of my current courses that I'm taking... we were reading Mare of Casterbridge, and I was just thinking, you know, the Henchard, that chief character, he does all of his business by, you know, the handshake and word of mouth and, you know, all of the good, you know, as they quote it in the book, old-fashioned, you know, original way of doing things. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it occurs to me that, you know, Matt's family would have been pretty much the same.
Yeah.
A man's word is his bond.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah,
what have we been talking about this entire time?
But Rand grew up pretty much the same way, and, you know, he has no problem with it. I felt Matt was dumbed down a lot.
I still honestly don't think that Brandon has quite got Matt right. He's a little bit too juvenile compared to what he was in, you know, Crossroads and Knife of Dreams. He had just matured more than that. He sounds too young. And I still cannot, I'm sorry, I know Brandon is not trying to imitate RJ, and he's using his own style as adapted and so forth, but the whole thing was just too colloquial for me. There were too many places where Aes Sedai and Wise Ones used contractions that they never used before. And,
right. You know,
and Birgitta and Plays, they were saying things like, sure wouldn't, nope, didn't do that. You
that
know,
was, and also,
I didn't like it.
But I noticed it, especially with Matt and Tom,
yeah,
that their speak was just too modernized.
Yeah, too colloquial.
There were a lot of things that, especially Tom said, that were things that we, like, almost slang things that we say now.
Yeah.
That just didn't sit. And I thought
no, because he was well spoken, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that.
So Tom is very literate and well-spoken, and he would have never, I don't believe he would have ever said some of the things that Tom said.
There were a couple that really bothered me, and I wish I would have written them down, because I remember thinking, that's something that people would say now. It was something like, I can't even, but it drove me nuts, actually.
Yeah, I think the one that jumps into my mind is they're sitting down at the inn, and Matt asks something about what does everybody have? What did you bring in the way of music or whatever? And Tom says, I got us a variety. But this doesn't sound like Tom to me, you know? I could see him saying, I brought us, I procured a number of different items, you know, or something
right.
like that. He was very well spoken, you know.
So none of these characters are stock characters necessarily, but do you see Nat as sort of the peasant warrior? I mean, he's the classical Joker, right? But you have Tom to play the role of the Gleeman. So what cloth is he cut from, and is that part of the challenge in building him as a character? Right, because you know you're talking about his sort of peasant background, and Rand is more the noble young lord. Right, so where's Matt?
I think it was really funny that Tom made a comment that is every farm boy I've ever met going to turn into a nobleman?
yeah, Taverin. Yes.
Yeah.
yeah, probably. Well, about your question, I think if I mute myself for another 3 seconds, we might actually be able to hear me. But about what kind of the generic story type story archetypes of characters, I think we for any of the three boys actually they aren't any one character. I think the three of them together make up the hero character. To my mind, I know we tend to think, oh, Rand is the hero, and Matt and Perrin, yeah, they're good, but they're not as good as Rand, because Rand's the Dragon Reborn, and the others are just Taverin. But really, I think the three of them together are what make up the central hero, the archetypal hero character. You take traits from Matt and from Perrin and from Rand, and mix them all together, and then you have your archetypal hero. I don't think there's any of them that have that fill the role all by themselves.
I kind of disagree with that a little bit. I really think that Rand and at least Rand and now Perrin are really filling into the hero shoes in pretty much every sense of the word. Matt, he's a little different. Matt's sort of a hero, but he's dragged into it kicking and screaming. You know, he's really more of the loci type of person. He's a really powerful person, but he's a jokester.
But right, he's the rogue. He's the ruffian.
Not serious.
He's the, you know, the rogue and the ruffian, and in a sense, the playboy. Not that I mean that in the sort of modern sense, but, you know, the eternal young trickster, as you say, the Loki.
And you think about it, of the three of them, he's the warrior. Rand's obviously the noble leader, lord. Perrin is a lot the same thing, but Matt isn't. Matt is much more a warrior type.
Mm.
I think Matt's a hero. I just, because he's reluctant at it, and he's not, it's not something that he's like, oh, I want to be a leader or I want to be a hero. But once he knows that it has to be done, he's always there and he always does what he needs to do. It's just not something, a role that he wants to step into for, you know, for the rest of his life.
If I can make a more modern reference, it's not really a literary reference, it's a film reference, but Matt almost reminds me a little bit of, well, several characters in movies, but the first one that springs to my mind is Bruce Willis's character of John McClane in the Die Hard movies. I mean, you know, he's always in the wrong place at the wrong time. He always has to pull everybody's bacon out of the fire. He's just like, he's always grumbling like, oh, John, just come out to the West Coast, have a little fun, look what happens. He's always grumbling and everything, but he's always right there, always saving the day, and he's always wisecracking, you know, and that really is a Matt sort of a thing. You know, that's
true.
Matt has better hair.
But what I like about that, actually, as an analogy, is sort of the sense of sacrifice, right? The Mr. Church character, right? What was his name in Die Hard?
Sorry?
What was the name in Die Hard?
Oh, John McClane.
That's right. So the John McClane character, you know, does sacrifice personally, right? And you have that in Matt's character, and clearly in this episode. Right, the loss of the eye is a clear sacrifice that comes through.
Yeah.
But it's a nice connection as well.
Yeah.
Well, they seem like similar personality types to me. In a lot of ways, you know, the joking and not taking things too seriously, and you know, the reluctant hero is always very appealing. We have a lot of that in our culture these days. You know, the guy who's thrown into a situation. Raven's a little bit that way too. He's thrown into a situation that's just way more than you would expect anybody to be able to handle, and they manage to pull through and do the right thing and, you know, bring it to a good resolution despite the fact that they never really wanted that job, but that's what makes you that guy.
could you not totally see if this was, since we're talking about the modern slang with the this Towers of Midnight book, if, you know, they were using our talks, our speech in this day and age for Matt to say John McClane's famous line, you know, that Yippee-ki-yay one?
Yeah, I totally see him saying that. I mean, actually, that kind of flashed through my mind a little bit when he was doing it. Have a grand bloody day.
Yeah,
you know?
I just picture him flipping on the bird, you know, like.
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels between those two characters, and I almost hesitated to mention it because I particularly like those movies and Bruce Willis in those movies, and I thought, well, maybe I'm just stretching it because, you know, I happen to be a fan, but but I feel the similarities in the personality types.
That's
you know.
I
always and the one thing that Justin Long said to Bruce Willis in the last movie, you know, where he's saying, well, you know, I didn't want to do this, and why are you doing this? You know, well, there's nobody else.
Right.
That's why I'm doing it. And then he says, well, that's what makes you that guy. You know? And I thought, well, that pretty much sums it up. You know, these are the guys that are doing it. And Rand is constantly harping on that theme. You know, duty is heavier than a mountain. Death is lighter than a feather. He has to do it. There isn't anybody else.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
It's really an ongoing
theme.
Yeah. And Matt's really the same way. He's exactly the same way. There's nobody else he's got to. And even Perrin now has come to the conclusion that he has to be a lord, and now he actually wants to be a lord because there isn't anybody else.
Right.
Yeah.
If there is somebody else, he can't trust that they are going to do what needs to be done.
Right, and do it right. Yeah, so they're all kind of coming to the same conclusion, you know, in their different ways, but it's the same basic thing. They're just, because they're different personality types, they're coming at it from slightly different directions. I think probably
Matt's view
is almost the most healthy of the three.
Yeah, well, and also the big difference between Perrin and Rand and Matt is that they all kind of have the warrior type. You know, they can get in there and fight. The thing is, Matt is pretty much only, I hesitate to say only, but mostly the warrior type. Sure, he can lead the men, but he is not at all a good administrator, which is why he has Talmanes with him, because Talmanes can administrate the things. And whereas Rand and Perrin, you know, they have to be leaders, administrators over the people that they have under their care. Whereas Matt, you know, as a general of his army, he has other people that can do the administrative work, and he can work on how to get everyone's butt out of the fire.
Well, he's a strategist, not a, you know, he's actually good at tactics, too. But, you know, his job and what he realizes is his job is to lay out the grand plan, the strategy, the battle plan that's going to happen, and how to cope with all the things. He's actually not a bad administrator. He just doesn't like it, you know. But one has to wonder how much of Matt's abilities to organize and command an army, at which he's really good, are a function of his natural abilities and the function that he apparently has some sort of a past life than even before the Finns gave him the memories, because they called him the Son of Battles right off the bat.
Well, yeah, even before he went to Ruhigen, when he had the healing from the Shadar Logoth dagger, and even before that, in Eye of the World, you know, he had to bleed through from Manethrin and the Battle of Aemon's Field.
Yeah.
One of the first words out of Matt's mouth when we first meet him, when they're talking about it, and the Padden Fain, the peddler's wagon pulls up and everything, and Tam and some others are talking, and says, oh, it's mostly just news of battles, you know, nothing of interest. And Matt says, battles interest me.
Mm-hmm.
Right off the bat. He's fresh off the farm.
Yep. Well, you know what I find the most interesting about his early memories is that the entire dream sequence we have, the healing and the beginning of Dragon Reborn, is the memory that he has of the person that he is at that point. It's just one of the common grunts. It's one of the grunt soldiers on the front lines. It's not one of he's not a person of any status or nobility, and yet look at what he's become since then.
Right.
Yeah, I still just love that line of Tom's. Is every farm boy I know going to become a nobleman?
Taviren. Tell you, Taviren.
Yep, they probably
Taviren,
will.
It's everywhere you want to be.
I love it.
Look at your Taviren. Now look at me. Now back at your Taviren. Now back to me.
Look at me.
Sadly, he isn't me.
You are not Taviren.
No, actually, it's going to be Brandon Sanderson presents Taviran the Scent.
Taviran.
I love it. You know, that's actually not a bad idea. We should present that to them. They could probably make some money off of that.
Well, you know that after the movies and such start coming out, that they're going to have all sorts of weird junk. the Taviran, the Lord of the Rings perfume, Lord of the Rings. Well,
smell like a hero to your woman.
Yeah, the Wheel of Time, the perfume line fragrances. Well, there's already jewelry, but there's going to be like whole oodles and gods more of it. I can't wait to see some really interesting T-shirts based on good one-liners.
Yeah.
I don't know what line is there in Wheel of Time and this is an actual question. Answer it to the best of your ability. What line is there in the Wheel of Time that is as good as "You shall not pass"?
Hmm. Blood and bloody ashes.
No, there's.
No, definitely don't want to use mother's milk in a cup. No. Nobody would get that, and it's stupid anyway.
I'm constantly thinking.
Actually, the grave is no bar to my call.
Oh, yeah. I am not a bloody hero.
Yeah, that's not a bad one.
I just can't think of any off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well,
Tyshar Malkier.
Yeah, I was going to say Tyshar Manethrin, and then I decided, well, that would be a good T-shirt, but only the Wheel of Time fans would get it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, "You shall not pass" has almost become a staple of our culture now.
Time to toss. It's time to toss the dice.
Yeah,
there we go.
One of my favorite
there
girls
we go.
Goodreads.
The question is,
Dovie Ande.
I was going to say, Andrew, you say it.
I'm trying to remember the final bits of it because I don't have it in front of me.
I've got it.
Dovie Ande, Sagan, something like that.
No, it's Doviande Setovia Sagan.
The question is, how would they get Matt to say it in the first movie? Because it has to be in the Eye of the World, otherwise it wouldn't be.
And my other favorite one, "Luck is a horse to ride like any other."
Yeah, that one isn't as well known, though.
That's in the old tongue, too. Yeah, but I like it.
Yeah, it's a good one, but it's not as well known. I mean, "Time to toss the dice," everyone knows that one.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
Everyone. How many times did Brandon have to sign that in the book? He had the old tongue version of it sitting in front of him so that he wouldn't get it wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's kind of sad because, you know, I of course go up and ask for, you know, my famous catchphrase at the end of the novel. He looks at me and he goes, "Okay, you're going to have to spell that for me."
I know.
Yeah.
I know, and yeah. I have to say, if anybody's handwriting is worse than Matt's, it might be Brandon's.
Well, I mean, I guess it all depends, too, on when in the signing process you get a hold of him, too.
Well,
yeah.
It's a difference between hurried or tired handwriting and just, you know, his letters are not complaining, I'm not criticizing. His printing is really bad. It's just some people don't have good handwriting. That's the way it is.
Hey, it's enough better than mine that I can read it, okay?
Okay. Not complaining. I'm not criticizing.
Yep. Yeah, but "Time to Toss the Dice" or "May You Find Water and Shade," I think, are the two that he probably signed the most.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's you talk about, you know, "May You Find Water and Shade" is another phrase that could be carried out.
Yeah, that could be t-shirted pretty easy.
For
yeah, but there's no Aiel in Eye of the World, and so
no, you're
kind
talking,
of
right. You're talking about book number one, movie number one.
Well, yeah, movie number one, because it doesn't necessarily have to be in Eye of the World, because there are ways to write it into movie number one. I mean, if they don't write Aiel into movie number one, I'd actually kind of be surprised a little bit, just because the Aiel are such an amazing part of the book, but they don't have it. But we don't actually get to meet them until the middle of book two, and so. You want to get this amazing part out. If you're a filmmaker, you want to get this amazing part out as soon as possible. So you try and write it into book one as much as you can.
Oh, I don't know, but there's such a surf. What is the word I'm looking for? Surfeit? I can never pronounce
surfeit.
That properly.
Surfeit.
Surfeit. See, in me, you see a person who reads extensively and knows how to spell everything. I don't have these words in conversation with many people. So I have no clue how to pronounce them. It's been a problem for me my whole life.
You're not alone.
I don't have many friends that have vocabularies to the extent that I do. I have one. Shafit has never come up. So I have the most amazing lapses when it comes to pronunciation. But there's such a surfeit of Aiel in Book 4 that I don't know if we need to have them any earlier than that. I do have to say that I was in the fire, was it Book 4 or 5? The Fires of Heaven. I was really tired of the waste by the time that book was done. Really, really tired of the waste. Oh, I've said that before. I could not be an Aiel. It's just too hot and too dry for me.
I was as well. And as much as I love the Aiel,
I do love the Aiel. Could not
with them, you know, when they in the Fires of Heaven, when they came over and left the waste because it was getting a little.
Yeah, love the Aiel, hate the waste. Yeah. Could not live among them.
Oh,
not for long. Not unless they invent air conditioning. If I can have an exchanger like Grendel's, then I'll think about
shower.
It.
Or at least baths. I'm sorry, but I'm not really into a sweat tent or something. If they're going to do, you know, something like that every now and then, but that's not my ultimate way to clean myself.
Oh, you don't like scraping your sweat off with a spoon? Yeah. And sitting, and they're sitting on rock in the sweat tent. I mean, they're sitting on the dirt on rock. That, no. I don't want to be hot and sweaty and dirty. That is not getting clean in my book. Sorry, you're right.
Even if you are scraping the sweat off, still it's ew.
Like
I'm still,
it and
still
it's just like it's just you're just pushing it down to your I imagine this trail.
You're still sitting in the dirt, sweating.
Yeah.
What's clean about that? There is no clean involved there.
How do they wash their hair? I mean, honestly, their hair.
I don't know.
Their hair is kept in good repair and kept good looking, but if they just clean it with sweat. Really?
Avienda said that they do wash it, and then they have some shampoo made from a plant, which I presumed was the equivalent of jojoba or something. But that seems like it would be a huge waste of water to me. If they won't use it on their bodies, why would they use it on their hair?
Right. And, you know, if it's not something that they're doing all the time and they're not born, you know, washing their hair and stuff, their hair probably, that would be natural for them and it wouldn't be as greasy as, like, us if we weren't a washer. You know?
Well, I've heard that before. I actually had a friend of mine that was really into, not primitive living, but, you know, non-technological living. And she said that you almost never need to wash your hair if you really just brush it and brush it and brush it all the time and never wash it.
Yeah.
And I'm going, yeah, okay for you, honey. I wash mine every morning. That's it. I'm done. I'm not going there.
They always tell me
I tried that for one day. I lasted
and
one day.
It's so crazy, so I try to skip every other day, but it's so hard. They say, eventually, if you just try to put your hair up and don't wash your hair every day, then it won't get so greasy. But it drives me nuts. So.
Yeah,
right,
I have problems when I try and brush my hair constantly throughout the day. It just doesn't work out as well for me.
Yeah, like that tousled look. You're into that matte look.
It's actually supposed to be funny because I don't really have that much hair, but whatever, you can laugh at whatever makes you
fail.
I suck at the joke telling, so it's okay. Just laugh at whatever.
Boy, I'm going to go into a Ken Swain mode here. Boy, you're in big trouble if you don't have a lot of hair now and you're 20.
Well, no, I keep it short.
It's short.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not that I'm missing the hair. It's just that I keep it short.
I gotcha. Okay, I gotcha. All right, so back to the Power of Genji. Anything else new and exciting that we want to talk about with that? We really have digressed again.
Do we want to talk about the Jane reveal?
I think one of the major things that we absolutely need to talk about if we're talking about the Power of Genji is the fact that we finally find out, kind of again in a throwaway line, like every other big reveal in this book, that Noel is Jane Forestrider. I mean, we kind of realized that, but still it's nice to have the confirmation.
Yeah. Was there anybody that didn't know that? I mean, you know.
It seemed odd to me that when he said that, it seemed like Matt was just like, okay, Jane, you know, like he accepted it. It seemed like he was almost expecting it or had already thought it. But then later, right? Yeah, I know. But then later when Matt was going back and thinking about Tom, when did he know, you know, and trying to piece it out, it seemed like Matt had no idea. But from the beginning, when he first found it, I thought he did have an idea. So I was a little confused with that.
Yeah, I think that was just an error, possibly.
Well, I don't know if it was an error so much as, well, you know, I'm sure Matt was suspicious up until the point that Noel said, oh, I'm his cousin. And I was like, okay, that I guess that actually makes sense. But, and then when he said, I'm Helen Jane, whatever, you know, at that moment, yeah, it didn't really register how big of a shock it was. But later, when he wasn't running for his life, he thought about it and was like, oh my gosh,
that's true. That's, I just thought he would have, he seemed like when he said it, and he's like, okay, Jane, you know, I'll tell them. It just seemed like he knew, like to me, it just seemed like, yeah, he knew. I don't know. I guess he didn't, but that's just how I took it. And then later on, he was saying he did it, and I was like, what?
And what do you think about sort of his end here, right? I mean, is, you know, he's such a long-lasting character in some ways that it's fascinating to me that, you know, that we lose him in Finland.
You know what it was, too? That burned me.
Sorry.
I know.
There's just something ridiculous about saying we lost Jane Barstrider in Finland.
Well, it is true. It reminds me of the Finland.
It's a country,
it's country
for
you. Yeah, that's what he said.
I said England.
Finland?
Well,
yeah, that's a
Spamalot
reference for those of you that aren't playing along.
For those of you playing the what are we going to talk about next bingo, fourth age bingo game at home, that was Spamalot. It also counts as Monty Python as the Holy Grail, which we make sure is on the board every day. No, you know, the end for Noel, I think, was a fitting end for Noel. I don't know that it was a fitting end for Jane Farstrider.
For Jane.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
right.
We've had Jane Farstrider, literally, we've had him in the book since almost chapter one of Eye of the World. Maybe chapter two. I don't remember exactly when Rand goes
the
into
book
the
gets
end.
Mentioned.
Right.
But we've had him in there since almost the very beginning of the series, and he's again, it just kind of throw away. Oh, yep, he's dying, bye.
It seemed like a waste because...
It didn't... The weight of the sacrifice didn't really hit me in the way the scene was written. Maybe that's just because I'm sick and twisted. I don't know.
Will he come back with the sounding of the horn?
Yeah. You know, I was kind of thinking that we will see him again, and I don't think he's alive, mind you. But I was
oh, thanks.
Well,
we didn't see him die, and we didn't see
I know
close.
We didn't.
We just saw bloody knives.
I thought of that. I did think of that. I thought, oh, well, maybe he's not dead, because to me it seemed like a waste that he died that way. If he would have died sacrificing himself and they actually got out the way they intended, then it would have seemed more fit, you know. But because the fact that Matt figured out, oh, it just, I was just like, what? He didn't have to die. They could have just done that and been all, at, you know. I just was like, that's such a waste. And I did think, well, maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's going to pop back up. But then I thought, we only have one book left. We have a memory of life. Like, come
not
on.
Not a lot of time left.
How many more characters can we have come back from the grave? Like, or come back? Like, it's just, there's just not that much time. So I'm just going by.
Well, now I'm a little leery.
Something like that. Maybe we'll see him when the horn is blown. That would be awesome.
Now I'm a little extra weary, though, because you just said the phrase, you know, come back from the dead, and we do know that at some point in time, the shadow had something to do with Jane Farstrider.
That's true.
That's true.
But he's...
But he's repented.
Yeah, he's become a good person now, so I don't think the shadow will have sway over him.
If Ingvar could get out of it. Yeah,
but
no person has gone so far to the darkness they cannot return to the light. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, they're free for everyone to use. I just have to type in the right.
You remember that reference, though, right?
I do. I do remember the reference. I just have to get to someplace where I can look it up. There it is. And for those playing along at home, the website that I'm looking up is bit.ly/WOT interviews, which is the Theoryland interview database that has been compiled by Therese and Madame Curie, Marie Curie. So let's see. Let's go down to Matt, because I think it'll be in here, and look for Snake.
You're cutting all this looking out. I'm going to tell you what my scream of anguish was for.
Huh.
There is one on the map page. I found it. It says, so at the Tower of Midnight book tour, in it was, well, I was there at the Barnes & Noble in New York. There was a question asked. No wonder it sounds so familiar. That was the one I was at. Well, everyone now went at Snakes and Foxes, and the answer was that nothing has been changed about the game.
Mm-hmm. So is that just, was that because of what was going on in the Tower of Genji that he won? Is that what we're supposed to assume?
That's what I'm wondering. That's the question, right?
That's what I was thinking. And that would make sense. Not really sure how, but...
Well, okay, and I think in order to properly address this question, obviously, because, as I said earlier in recorded form, good news, there's spoilers.
Good news, everyone.
It should be noted that the reason we are postulating this is that after Matt makes it back out of the Tower of Genji, Ulver actually manages to win the game with Thalmanis sitting there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, I thought, I just assumed that everyone knew what we were talking about. I'm so confused sometimes.
That's right up there with the dead walking and stuff.
Right, because we're constantly told this could never happen.
Right.
This could never happen. And so the analogy clearly is that Matt isn't intended to survive this sort of this trip and this interaction with the Finns. But the fact that that plays in the game as well is, it's got to be more than just a little bit of author sort of reflection. It has meaning, and the question is, what is the meaning?
I remember thinking when I was reading it that I was thinking the moment that Matt stepped outside the tower is when Ulver won, and Thalmanis was like, what? That's not possible.
No, I like that. I like that as an image, right? I like that because, in fact, what that means is that somehow Matt moving out of the tower created a loophole that allowed for the game to be won in that moment.
He won. He did. He won the game, like Matt won his game, and I'm pretty sure the Snakes and Foxes never thought that he would be getting out of that tower alive again at this point. It just kind of seemed symbolic to me.
Seems a little weird,
maybe,
though.
Right. I just figured that it was a function of reality breaking down like everything else.
Maybe. I honestly never thought of that, so it could be. I just kind of thought that it... And maybe it is. Maybe it's still somehow linked.
Could be.
To both of those, but...
To recall
the
that...
The fact
that
it's not going to happen again, though, seems to make it, to me, seem like even more proof that it is because of Matt getting out.
Yeah, well, I seem to recall that Brandon went into more detail on it at some point in time.
Oh, did he?
It wasn't in this interview, and I'm not sure if it even exists online anywhere, except maybe in our recording. I guess I actually have to go back and listen to that eventually now. Huh. But I seem to recall at some point in time his saying more on the subject along the lines of Ulver won because... Matt did, and that's the only time it's ever going to happen.
Okay.
Ever.
Okay.
But along the same lines, does anyone think we obviously know that Ulver has a purpose? We were told that in an interview answer from Robert Jordan back a long time ago about why Ulver was in the book. And the question, obviously, that everyone had at that point in time was, is Ulver Guy Dalkane? And the answer is absolutely no. No, the time does not work. That the time and
another purpose
doesn't work like that.
Something he says, right?
Yeah, it just does not work.
So I'm thinking something grander than just opening the letter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, RJ's direct quote is, he has another reason for being there besides being a red herring, though. And I think everyone, I know I did, and I know lots of others did, assumed before this point that his reason for being there was going to be something in the Tower of Genji, that somehow his knowledge of the game of Snakes and Foxes was going to be important in Matt and company getting in and out of the Tower of Genji.
Well,
but
I remember
obviously that didn't happen.
I remember speculation that he would be the third person.
Yeah,
that right,
somehow
that we'd lose,
Noel. I never
we'd
thought
lose
he was
all the, way.
The third person. Really.
Yeah.
No, I never thought
I always
that
thought
either.
It would be Noel, unless he somehow snuck in. But
yeah, I assumed that he would sneak in somehow, and Noel would die, and they'd still have three people. But
right.
But obviously that didn't happen.
Right.
And so what does Oliver have to do now?
Well, Oliver's there right now. With
he's in
Caimlin. So,
and now that we've seen a little bit into his thought process.
Right, and he's very excited to
creepy.
Get, you know, to...
Absolutely
he is
creeping for
a 10-year-old. So even if he's not, they're not Aiel, but at the same time, he's very anxious to go out and do something that's going to, you know, make a difference, it seems. So
Well, then his thought process, I mean, the creepy thoughts of this 10-year-old is, oh, yes, I'm just staying with him long enough to learn how to use a sword so I can go kill the guy who killed my dad, and then I don't know what I'll do after that. What?
Well, you know, at first it seemed really creepy to me, and then I was thinking, well, what would he be thinking? His family's dead. This is all, like, for him, this is what he's working toward. And I thought maybe that his purpose was to have something to do with the Aiel. He was going to kill somebody and it made a difference somehow. But I can't think of any way that's going to happen right now, because with all the Shido and all that, that's all gone right now. So my only guess is that it's going to have something to do with Caimlin, but it didn't come off as creepy the second time around for whatever reason.
It is. It's like creepy.
I'm trying to get, you know, he's young, and I'm trying to get into his head, but it was still kind of, I don't know, it was definitely weird. I had an off vibe, and I wasn't sure if it was just the writing or if it was just because he's you were in his thoughts, and he's so young, and he's so full of anger still, you know.
Is he meant to be Matt's son in some capacity? I mean, he plays that role, right? And is that a piece that he has purpose for, right? In other words, with with Juan, is he going to wind up with them at the end?
I totally was thinking of this. I was thinking the exact same thing. I was thinking that I can see Matt saying, okay, let's find him a nice family, and then not agreeing with any of them. I don't think we'll try to see this, but, and then being like, and then just him and Tuan taking him in and raising him as their own. I kind of picture that myself.
And could that be what RJ meant, that he has a purpose? I mean, he is, you know, so.
But will we see that, or will that, what is that purpose of that, though? What's the purpose of him being his son, except maybe to be an heir someday?
Well, he enlightens Matt's sort of self-delusion around you know, the impact he's having on him. He's playing the role. So if Matt is the boy prince, you know, then Oliver is the boy. Yeah. But he serves to sort of illuminate how boyish Matt is really being in some ways.
Yeah, that's true. I still think he's going to do something that has something to do with Caimlin. Just like
has
an impact on what's going on there right now.
Yeah, I really think that anything he's going to have to do will have to have impact on a memory of light, and him
right.
being maybe even raised to the status of one of the Empress's children wouldn't have any impact on a memory of light. It would have impact on possible Outrigger novels,
right?
But
we haven't seen any hint of the power in him at this point. That's the other question is, will he
get
be
over?
Yeah,
no, not that I know of. But then he's pretty young yet,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Might not have manifested it.
Yeah.
And will there be something that will bring it out in the last battle? That's the other question.
Yeah, I think he's still way too young. I think you have to at least have gone through puberty first.
Yeah, I don't know. Do we really need more channelers?
No.
Got
Oshiman.
Well, except
now, because
that,
we have Oshiman calling out our ears, and none of them are good people.
Except that a channeler close to Matt who hates channelers would be really interesting.
That would be.
Well
he's
you know,
Tuan, who can learn to channel.
For that.
Yeah, every woman in his life is a channeler, pretty much, except for Aludra.
We assume Aludra doesn't have the ability to learn how to channel.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right.
Of course, you know, Tuan does share a lot of his same hesitance towards the power, although hers is fired into a more hateful frenzy. Just real quick, a verbal raise of hands. Did anyone else want to hit Tuan when she was thinking, oh, now we have to travel into the basement of the White Tower and kill them? I'm like, no, stop, idiot woman. I liked you.
Yeah.
The White Tower is doomed.
I was just thinking, what the bananas is going on? Like, we have the last battle. The last memory of light is the last battle. Like, we don't have time for Tuan to be doing this crap. What's going on?
Yeah, no kidding.
You know?
I loved her thought. I mean, we think of the Tower Shakes, that chapter in the Gathering Storm, the amazing, awesome Egwene is awesome chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Gawain has to awesome. Anyway. And we think, wow, that's amazing. She just fought off the Shantan, and then we switch to the Shantan point of view. Oh, yes, the raid was a success.
Right.
What? What?
Well, especially now that they have traveling, right?
What would failure have been?
They got lots of Damani out of it. They captured a lot of Aes Sedai.
They don't have a weapon, so they're not scared of them.
Yeah.
Right? And now they know traveling. So it's like...
Yeah. Well, if it was a great success, though, what would have a hollow... What were they expecting? Were they expecting the same kind of quote-unquote Aes Sedai that they had back when Luthair Paindrag first came to Shantan, the kind that just willy-nilly kill things for fun? I mean, if that's what they were expecting, then yes, it was a success, because the Aes Sedai that they went against, there was only one of them who even sort of made a dent in the Shantan army.
Right.
So if the entire tower had been ready and able to protect it, I don't think the Tohrakan would have gotten within stone's throw distance of the tower, personally, maybe. But Egwene would have had to have been in control several months beforehand, at least 1 month beforehand.
Right.
That to have worked.
Yeah.
Set up a proper rotation of Aes Sedai on the top of the tower to scout. I'm babbling on now, so I'm going to shut up.
I was going to say, going back on talking about how they're going to go attack the White Tower right now. I was trying to think about, you know, is that going to happen again? You know, is that going to happen in the last book? And this links to...
If not, then when?
Yeah. When Rand has everybody at the very end of the Towers of Midnight, and he says he's gathered all the monarchs to get them to agree to something, right? And he doesn't know what he's going to do if they don't agree, but he's hoping that their intimidation and, you know, the rumors of his insanity and everything will maybe sway them. So are we supposed to assume that that is him making the peace pact? So I'm thinking Tuon has to be there for that, right? So maybe somehow she's going to be intercepted, or something is going to happen where Matt maybe comes in the picture or something. I have no idea what, so that he can make this pact. Because he says he has one last thing to ask from the monarchs of the world before he goes to fight the last battle for them. So is that what that is, or is it something else I'm missing?
Well, I was kind of guessing that might... I mean, if that's the way we're reading it, and I don't exactly remember everything, I think I originally read it as just they were marshaling their forces for the last battle kind of thing. But my thought, if that's what it is that is the installation of the Peace of the Dragon.
Yes.
That we see.
That's
and I mean,
right.
That just...
Yeah, that's what I meant. But then Tuon has to be there, because it was mentioned that the Empress at the time, which is Tuon, you know, in Avienda's, when she saw the future, obviously Tuon was there, because, right? So she has to be there for that. She can't go attack the White Tower. She's got to get there to sign that Petey. She's got to get there to sign that treaty, or whatever, the pact that he formed. Or whatever happens, Rand's got to kneel to her, not kneel to her, whatever. All that stuff's got to go down. So somehow she's got to get there, as opposed to the tower. So I'm thinking the whole tower thing's not going to happen. I hope. I don't know.
Well, I, for some reason, and I don't remember if Egwene had any other Aes Sedai with her when she went to the fields of wherever.
Melanor.
Yeah, and I just kind of... wonder, you know, Egwene's away meeting with the Dragon Reborn, and suddenly, boom, second strike on the White Tower.
Right.
With uber defensive, able to leap tall rockin' in a single bound, Egwene not there.
It would be devastating. I don't know. I just hope that really, I really hope that doesn't happen. I'm just sending, you know, good vibes out. Please don't write that. To Brian. No, I know it's not his choice, but that would severely suck in a big way.
Yeah.
But Tuon was there, right? Or am I wrong when Avienda saw the future when she was...
She wasn't actually there, but they referenced the fact that the first Empress had been somewhat more reasonable, but now that she was gone, there was no way to talk over anything with the Shantan.
Yeah.
They kind of mentioned her in passing.
The new Empress thought that she was below them, right? The Empress thought that Rand was below her, so they didn't have to follow the pact. Or am I thinking of something else?
I think that was the one after.
No, it's the final vision, and there's a comment about it being not that long after Termagaiden, but there's already been a new empress for several years.
Yeah.
So the other
That's kind of interesting.
Right, what happens to her?
Well, that actually raises another question. One of the things that we do know about who survives the last battle is that Martin was planning to write a book on Matt and Tuon.
Right.
Right.
So if she didn't survive very long past the last battle, what would be the point of that?
Right. So I'm just
Well, that leads me to the conclusion that Avienda's visions are not set in stone, but are mutable and can be changed.
Yeah.
Or
out of the waste and travels and senses Rand, finds him, and somehow changes the course of events.
Or something prompts Tuon to give up. Now, I know this is impossible to conceive of with the character we know to date, but that's why it would be more interesting, is that something prompts Tuon to give up being empress.
Well,
yeah.
The sense I got from reading...
Yeah.
The sense
I
got...
Sorry.
No, I was going to say, the sense I got from reading the... from reading that area, or that Avienda's vision, was the idea that it was a somewhat significant amount of time that had passed, and that, Tuon probably just fell to what any normal Shangjin empress falls to eventually, either being, assassination or something else to the effect, like, maybe, despite everything, during childbirth, she just didn't make it, or something to that effect. That there was some, maybe not satisfying, but logical answer that could account for Tuon not being there. Because they mentioned that the old empress might have been reasoned with to give the Aiel captives back. And even despite the fact that they are channelers. And Tuon, as we know her, could not have made that step. That would have either taken massive, massive, huge amounts of constant Taverinness influencing her, or it would have had to have taken something significant in her life that would then, for her, cause a realization of, well, maybe the ways that we are dealing with things aren't the ways that are necessary or even valid.
Or what do we know is Matt's role as the Prince of the Raven? What type?
Chick of power.
What can he do? Can he do anything? Do we know anything about that title and what can happen? I can't think right now.
We know that he can be a cupbearer.
Yes. We have to see more of Tuon and Matt, like them interacting in a more... Okay, I'm not saying that they're... Well, I hope we get to see something of them in some kind of acting in a marital status of some sort, like a couple, but there has to be something. He's Taviran. He married the Shangjian Empress. Like, there's a reason for that, So I'm thinking that either his title as Prince of the Ravens he has some right to change things, or Tuon will eventually either love him enough or be interested enough in his wacky ideas to kind of coddle him and give him some leeway for some of the things that he demands.
Yeah. Well, I would think, I don't know for a fact, but I would think that his status as Prince of the Ravens, he's obviously not going to be as high as the Empress.
Right.
Or he might not even be as high as the Daughter of the Nine Moons was before she died. But I think that she might be as high, that he probably is higher than Vesselin. And now this is getting really confusing, because guess what? It's the Shangxing culture, and it is confusing.
Well,
it's more confusing than Aiel humor, so...
That's true.
And what does it mean to be the Prince of Ravens? And ravens specifically, when we know that ravens themselves are a tool of the Dark One.
Well, yes, but that's the imperial sigil of Shangxing. So
right.
we know from that and other hints, or at least we can surmise that Ishamael had a large hand in the founding and the bringing up and the way that Shangxing is. He had quite a bit to do with.
Well, and that Matt gave up half the light of the world.
Well, yeah, that's
saved the world. And I found to take it right, but to take it all the way back, screeching all the way back to the Tower of Genji. to take us all the way back there. So that would be
a pre-industrial society, so it'd have to be horses whinnying and carts squealing.
There we go.
Sorry.
But that image of giving up half the light of the world, I think the phrase "the light of the world" is very interesting. I mean, obviously, it's an eyeball reference. But do you like that phrase, an eyeball reference?
Eyeball reference.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But is there more?
You know, I don't know. Because, well, I think we can assume that the fin have... which one was it? It was the ale fin that answered the questions, right?
Yep.
Okay, so we can assume that the ale fin have enough knowledge of human physiology to understand that light is what causes us to see. That the light burning our retinas is what causes us to be able to see colors. And so giving up half the light of the world could be a very valid, and I can't think of the word now, but it could be a very valid reference to just simply physiology, human physiology, that's the word. But that's not the way that it's used.
I have detailed files on human anatomy.
Yeah.
There's your Terminator reference for you, baby.
And now I'm going to really try too hard, and I know this is like stretching beyond capacity, but I'm going to stretch.
Okay.
Here's the evening stretch for you. So, yeah, you know, if he's given up half the light, will he have a memory of half the light?
Oh. I love it.
Thank you.
Particularly considering that Matt's head was filled with memories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Memories.
Anyway.
Memories.
But, yeah.
Like the half of the... Or like the half of the world's light.
Wow. Okay.
All right, no, and here's another.
No, Virginia, no. Okay.
Yeah, no, here's another weirdity for you. Okay, here's another crossover, and I don't believe I've done this one before. Here's a biblical one. Jesus was called the light of the world. Okay, are they casting Matt in a savior role? Is he going to take some of that away from Rand?
No.
Hmm. Well,
however, to give
up half the light of the world to save the world,
yeah.
That would make him
a
savior.
That
does, that's true.
Yeah, that does take us back into kind of the point I was making, you know, that they could have been talking from purely a physiological sense. But I don't think they would, because the phrase light is not used very often in that context. It's not used often in the in these books to describe the actual physical photons flying through the air. It's used.
I don't know. All right, I have to do this. I'm sorry. I don't know if you're waves or particles, but you go down. I don't do Bender well, sorry. Ah, sweet light.
No, but Spencer, your point
is... Sweet photons, that's what it is. Sweet photons. I don't know if you're waves or particles, but you go down smooth.
But Spencer,
sorry,
your point is...
Over. Thank you.
Your point is very valid, because light in this context often is the capital L, right? It's light versus the dark.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's a good question. I got to look it up. Keep talking.
So,
yeah, it's
so
very
what,
theological in that sense, yeah.
Right. So what is, you know, does half the light mean something more?
Yeah. You know, I totally see where... That it makes sense.
Ooh.
I never actually thought of it, though, because I just always, going back while reading the books, I always kind of, you know, it was always known, well, not always known, but we had always theorized that Matt was going to lose an eye from this.
Yeah.
In that, and
Does someone have the Shadow Rising handy? Because I looked it up on Encyclopedia Watt, and on the text they have, the word light is not capitalized.
Oh.
Which to me says that it's not referring
Shadow Rising. Yes,
that
I do. Have it on hand.
That it's not referring to the pseudo-religious version of the word light that is often used in the book.
Do you have the chapter?
It looks chapter 15.
15. Da, 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 da. 22 is not 15. 22 is distinctly more than 15.
It, it is? Wait, what?
Wait,
into the doorway. Scanning.
Processing.
It'll be probably 2 or 3 pages before the end of the chapter.
Right.
Maybe only one page.
Working.
That's purely from memory, so don't quote me on that. Anyway. Oh, this is interesting, just as a side note that we shouldn't talk about too long. We only know one of the answers that Rand got from the Aelfin, and we know nothing about the 3 questions Moraine asked.
Yes, an inquiring mind wants to know.
I hope we find it. We have to find out, right?
I hope we find out Moraine.
Rand. Oh, I want to know Rand.
Well, we know what two of the questions. We know what were. The one was, how do I win the last battle and survive?
Right.
And the answer, obviously, is the North and the East must be as one, the West and South. The two must be as one. If you would live, you must die. The other one was a question on how to cleanse Sadeen, and the answer was a riddle, which we don't know what the actual riddle was beyond that Hedred Fell says that it's now principles and all tied to a natural philosophy. And so unless it was in this book, and I'm missing it, because I don't think this page has been updated since Towers of Midnight came out, the third question and answer are unknown, except that we know that...
What is that horrible noise?
That is probably Andrew moving his mic boom.
Sorry, that was my fault. I had to go silence a cat.
Ooh, cat silencing.
Well, not really. She'll be bothering me again in a second, I imagine.
Oh, not permanently. She does not sleep with the fishes or anything like that.
Oh.
She might want to sleep with the fishes, but that's
she might.
I want my sound clips because we have some good ones with Andrew and his cat in a box in a bag.
She might want to eat with the fishes.
So did you find the quote, Andrew? Still looking.
See, their feet were atop the pedestals. He could not tell which shrieked the answer to marry the daughter of the nine moons, to die and live again, and live once more a part of what was. Ugh.
That's in one.
To die and live again and live once more a part of what was.
That sounds like the memories in his head.
To die and live again and live more a part of what was sounds like him being brought back by Balefire.
Oh,
but
that's
anyway. And then to give up half the light of the world to save the world, light is not capitalized.
All right. So it might not have the pseudo-religious overtone that we want to ascribe to it.
Or it might.
Well, I don't think that RJ would have done that. I think if RJ meant capital L light, he would have written capital L light. Because these nitpicky things are the kind of things that he excelled in.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I could just be reading too much into it. I'm known to do that every once in a while. Like, always.
Oh, none of us have ever done that before.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about. I'm sure I wouldn't know.
Me either.
Here's an interesting thing. Obviously, the book ends with a huge cliffhanger. We have Camelin on fire. And yet, it also tells us, the book also tells us that we don't have to be too worried about Camelin on fire.
That's true.
Yep. Back in Avienda's.
That is if the future doesn't change.
Well, I don't think that bit of the future. Avienda is going to try and change
That's
the future.
That's true. But she hasn't done it yet.
But I don't think that this is something she could have changed. That this is something along the line of.
Yeah.
But because it's just kind of a little bit of
but
setting.
But you know, that was a long time. That's a very long time to.
It's only two generations,
I know,
which obviously it is time to rebuild. Obviously, so but still we don't have to be worried that Camelin is going to be stricken off the map because.
No, I'm not worried that it's going to be stricken off the map, but I just think.
Well, yeah, people are going to die. Obviously, people are currently dying at the end of the book. People are dying, and death and fire are raining down.
Yeah.
But Onkala, Avienda's granddaughter, is walking through the halls of. Or walking through the streets of Camelin.
Yeah. And we
so
know
obviously
that
Camelin isn't completely destroyed.
We also know that they at least have the dragons still in the future, right? And the dragon eggs, because they were referenced.
Yes, the dragons were referenced in the visions.
So is this one of those quantum things, like in knowing, that movie Knowing, you know? So the future changed because you looked at it? Gotta bring in Schrodinger's cat here, too.
No, because if you bring in the cat, then we'll know it exists, and it'll change the outcome.
I collapsed your brain function, sorry. Sorry, man. I can have cheeseburger now. I'm in your quantum box, in your wave function.
See, you know what? There needs to be, on the Lolcat site, a picture of a box that says, it is dark, I can have light now, please.
I can have light now? Yeah.
Which just like the word Schrodinger on the side of the on the side of the box.
Well, do it. Just take a picture of a box with a couple of eyes on the side. A couple of holes that have eyes looking out them.
I can have light now.
It's dark. I can have light now.
Yep.
Yep.
I promise it will not change anything. Open the box now, please.
I promise this. Yeah. I promise not to corrupt your wave function.
Okay.
Well, you know, but you know, I laugh about this stuff, and I've said this before. You know, Robert Jordan had a degree in physics, and it's not beyond the possibility that this stuff was rattling around the back of his brain when he was writing this.
Yeah.
Well.
So, do you think that Mind Troll will be able to figure out how to use the dragons?
Well, my bigger worry at the moment is the last image we get of Camelin is in flames. I'm more worried about the warehouse where they're being stored going up in a massive and...
the powder warehouse.
And I can just see Aludra cursing all the way.
Yeah. It blew up my dragons!
Or, of course, that opens up for the possibility of another kind of really... possibly powerful but maybe throwaway sort of scene where, you know, they've got, you know, people are rushing in to try to do something to save Camelin, and you have Aludra there at the warehouse, literally just boom blam.
Yeah, that would be sad. Or you have a better scene than Aludra going up with her warehouse, which would be sad, is because you know that she sleeps with those things. You know she does.
I just see her, like, bashing in everyone that tries to get in there. Just sit there and...
Yeah, but then fire catches to the back of it. She isn't aware of it until it hits the powders, and then she's gone. But, no, a better idea is that Talmanes gets into town with the band. They force the Trollux and Mydrel into the warehouse before the fire gets there. And just hold them there until it goes boom.
Yeah, good one.
Although I'd love to know what
funny
they're going
thing
to do about the Waygate.
Funny thing, and I can almost see it being that way. If we're going to have the entire lure them in and then blow the warehouse with them inside, it's got to be Aludra that sets it off, and I know exactly how she has to do it. My wife and I last night just started watching a couple episodes of the original Sanctuary. And I can just see Aludra standing in that the 1884 outfit, where she's got the lace at the collar and her, you know, proper coat and the skirts and everything, and just, you know, pulling out the first pistol, which of course, you know, she probably has created or at least thought of, and, you know, firing it into the warehouse, and it just.
Except that wouldn't work unless you had an incendiary shot, which
true.
I'm not sure that she would be comfortable with making a dragon egg small enough that she could shove it in there and then light it off.
I don't know how.
I think it would go off too soon.
You could.
Isn't this getting kind of steampunk for us?
You just have an iron.
We have into the Wheel of Time. That's steampunk, sweetheart.
Oh my god.
All you really need is two pieces of metal striking each other for a spark in a warehouse filled with gunpowder.
That's true.
So you have a piece of iron shot from the pistol. You strike any freaking metal post, and
that's
whoom.
What Tom thinks anyway. No, it has to have some context.
Well,
it can't just be laying around in bags and somebody strikes a spark and it all goes up. It's not in the air. I mean, good grief, ships used to carry, you know, magazines full of gunpowder all the way across the ocean. There was fire all over the place, but as long as you don't touch it to the gunpowder. I mean, have you ever actually tried to light gunpowder in a cannon or something like that? It's not always that easy to do. It takes a little time to actually get gunpowder to ignite.
Yeah.
Look at how easy it is to get cannons to fire.
When have you had that opportunity, Virginia?
I was going to say.
You'd be surprised.
I have never been able to do that.
Yeah, Andrew, I think to set the gunpowder off, we're more likely to either see a trail of gunpowder leading off that she sets off with a striker, and so we can see through the generic along the snake back to the huge pile of powder. Wow, say that five times fast.
You know, she's pretty crafty. If she's going to do this, she's going to plan it out and figure it out.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah,
it'll
either be the snake, of, the generic snake of gunpowder, which I don't see from RJ, or she'll toss one of her night flowers in there like Matt did to the...
Or just get somebody to open a gateway and, you know, drop a, you know, Molotov cocktail in that puppy.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Postal
Wham!
Delivery.
Yeah.
Okay, question.
Page boy!
Question. According to Varen's letter, you
actually,
know...
Wait a minute. I actually want to do that in the Tower of Genjai more, okay? Can you open a gateway? Can you open a gateway inside the tower?
Probably
while you're
inside, yes. I don't think you can open one from the outside to the inside, no, because it's in a different world, we assume.
Yeah.
But,
who says gateways can't go to a different world? Portal stones do.
Yeah, portal stones.
Who says they can't?
That was
interesting. You can open a gateway to the freaking world of dreams, for crying out loud.
I thought for some reason you couldn't, or why wouldn't they have done that?
I don't know. Oh, he didn't thought about it. He didn't think about it. This Matt, he's not a gateway sort of guy. He scrounged that one just because he didn't want to, mainly because Tom didn't want to spend weeks getting there and back.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Here's the question now that we kind of brought it up twice here. One is Varen's letter to Matt. You know, they will assume that the gate is that the way gate in Camelin is. That the way gate in Camelin is locked, and then also, the one who unlocked it, or did they unlock it, or did they just, you know, blast a hole into it, a la Moraine and Eye of the World? And secondly, who was portal stoning the Trollocs in to surround the White?
You cut off.
Oh, after
cut off, say that again.
Whatever chapter that was.
You cut off. Say that last part again. Who was portal stoning the Trollocs in what?
To surround the White Cloaks when Perrin came to their rescue and killed people, killed things, lots of things, and epic slaughters, and it was pretty.
I don't think he was using the portal stones.
They were.
Yeah, they were, yeah, that was mentioned.
Well, according to
Perrin
the text, they were.
Did he say that? Mm-hmm. What did
Perrin mention
that?
That they were right around them, and that's what he had thought,
oh,
right?
Okay.
I think that's what happened. Ugh.
Well,
right,
the portal
now,
stone makes more sense than a waygate in that case.
Yeah.
Well, and they did need a channeler to do it.
Because remember, Perrin said that's why he thought that those ruins looked familiar, and he recognized it. That's
okay.
When he started thinking about, oh, I better go back, right?
Well, and also, you know, we know a gateway wouldn't have worked because the Shadow Spawn can't travel through gateway. Waygate probably would not have worked. Wouldn't. If there had been a waygate there, then there would have been a grove there, and there wasn't. But any place that there would have been a waygate that wasn't near a steading would have had a grove, and in that kind of overgrown area, the grove wouldn't have been cut down. So there were none of the signs of a waygate, so the best choice is portal stone.
Incidentally, I don't remember where this was, but there was a discussion about the golem going through the waygate and why it didn't kill it. And Brandon, I think, either on his own or through Maria, answered the question that by the time the golem was created, Aghanor had actually figured out the problem that was causing other Shadow Spawn to die and therefore made them immune.
Okay. Well, actually, I didn't really have a problem with that because it said that the ones that Rand had learned that the ones that went through a waygate, or somebody had learned that the ones that went through a waygate didn't always die immediately. They died later. No, that was the traps he set. Never mind. Take it back. I lied. Never mind.
Yeah.
Is that in reference to an actual gateway that he had traveled through at some point, or the skimming gate?
No, I don't know.
That Matt pushed him through and then off into the side into the epic crash of doom.
Originally, when Rand makes the revelation that Shadowspawn are killed by gateways, I am pretty sure it's mentioned that it doesn't matter if it's skimming or actual
right.
gateway traveling, that in either case, it is fatal.
Yeah. Well, my question is more, have we actually seen the golem go through any other gateway? Because I don't remember if we have.
No, I don't think we have.
I don't think we have either.
The question was asked at some point as to either how the golem was showing up in places or something like that. And the answer is that the golem actually was able, through the same thing that made them immune to Weaves of the One Power, to actually pass through gateways without dying.
Mm. Well, that's interesting.
I think it's really cool. I think it's really cool that one of my favorite methods of body disposal was actually used to get rid of the golem. I've been saying for a couple years now. It's like, especially after Halima trekked through the snow with the body of one of Egwene's maids. I don't remember if it was Mary or Salami or Salami or whatever her name was.
Salami.
It's Salami. It's spelled like it should be Salami or Salami or whatever. Anyway. Yes, Salami. she's like reflecting on how hard it was to escape the notice of all the, soldiers and everything as she's dragging this body through the snow and everything so she could bury it where it'll never be found until it's thaw and they'll be gone. And going like, well, you dummy, you're forsaken. Let's just open a gateway and shove her through. Duh. Let it fall endlessly. It's a good way to get rid of a body. I thought that for years, and I'm like, finally, somebody figured out how to use that. Good job, Matt.
Yeah.
What that says about my turn of mind, I don't know. I haven't actually had the opportunity to dispose of any bodies, but one can.
Oh, here it is. I found what you were it looks like what you were referring to, Andrew. It's from the Paris, from one of his Paris. Some stop on his Paris book tour with a Jonathan B. reporting that they discussed the golem, and if someone had pushed it through a gateway, would it have just died? Brandon said that the golem can go through gateways from one place to another. He mentioned that this was the first time he had shared this information. Golem are shadow swan of a more perfected kind. It would have been way too easy to kill if you just needed to shove it through a gateway. However, falling through a skimming gateway for a few minutes did kill the golem, and it is really dead and not going to show up again.
Ta-da! Yeah, because you're falling into that endless space.
Wait,
and the golem
falling for a few minutes killed it?
Yeah,
I would hope that it would have starved to death rather slowly over the period of several days.
Yeah. At least. I suppose
and
it
then,
would be too much to ask that it would die of terror,
Oh, and then there's more here, which is probably the one that you were actually thinking of Andrew. This is from the Cincinnati signing, so this is probably. It says that I asked Brandon, said Shadowspawn die when they go through gateways. Was the golem dead, or is it a construct? Brandon explained to me that it was not Shadowspawn, and a gateway would not kill it. However, he went on about Golem being limited by someone who can travel. I didn't push that response because someone constantly being hunted, but invariably have a moment where they were unawares. This was not really a limitation for the Golem to hunt animals who can travel.
Hmm.
Interesting. Did they say more about him on this page?
Where's the wind coming from? I feel like there's wind or something.
Andrew, did you set your phone down on the computer again?
Yeah.
No,
Andrew,
I had to stand up or something. It might have been the vent.
Don't
blowing
do that.
Heat out.
Well, it's still blowing.
Let me sit
Throw
down.
Throw it on the ground.
Oh,
don't do that.
Okay. We're good.
Sorry, environmental hazards.
Throw them on the ground. Don't set them on the computer.
Well, this is an
We're
interesting
owl exterminators.
All we are is dust in the wind.
All we are is dust in the wind. Yep, I know that song.
I am slowly fading. If you can tell, I'm like really quiet. I'm going to have to...
We wound up spending another couple of hours not talking about the Tower of Gentry, which is pretty impressive.
It went into a general Towers of Midnight discussion again, because it always will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We started out with the best of intentions and talking about Matt.
Well,
note.
And we ended talking about the golem, which Matt killed, so we're good.
Right.
Note that I said in the beginning, when I finally managed to get through the introduction, I said, this is our intent. Our actions did not meet our intentions, and therefore we are fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our
Sorry, not really.
Yeah. Our actions came close. They were close. We stayed on the general topic of the Tower of Genji.
Matt.
We did. And we would trail off and then go back to it,
Yeah.
someone would drag us kicking and screaming back to the Tower of Genji, and we were there.
Yeah, so I'm supposed to be the conductor here and keeping order, and I'm one of the worst ones to drag us off topic, but I did try to bring us back a couple of times.
in your defense, Jason's email never really said that you had to be the one.
No.
And as a matter of fact, by his original wording, before he actually used your name and that, technically I would be the moderator.
Yeah, really.
But I think he seems to forget every now and again that I actually, you know, have been here since, you know, episode, what, 17, 19?
Yeah.
One of those teen episodes that I can't remember.
Well, I keep saying I'm going to nominate you as producer. I don't know how I ended up with the job just because Andrew Miller abdicated.
Everyone else took a step backwards, Virginia. Haven't you figured that out?
Yeah, exactly.
Those goes.
I have enough familiarity with the military to realize that one should never volunteer for anything. But I haven't learned to step back quick enough. You're right about that. Yeah. No, you know what? You know why I got the job? By virtue of being there all the time. I show up all the time. I have no life, so I'm always available.
Now I'm worried.
So anybody else can have the job as soon as they just speak the words.
We all step back,
nobody,
by the way.
Yeah.
Those magic words are, of course, I'm never going to say them, so you can, never mind.
Biggie Smalls.
I volunteered for producer.
Oh, look at that. A South Park reference in Wheel of Time.
But I didn't want to be a host. I just wanted to help out.
Yeah, you didn't want to be a host.
I didn't want to be a host. I was like, well, Carrie.
You were designated.
Carrie Jason. It's like, can you set, you know, whenever you and Jason get together talk, see how this goes. It's like, yeah, I don't know how comfortable I am with that. Sorry.
Well, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
And now
I'm
you're
okay
stuck
now.
With it. Ha, ha, ha.
Until you guys start coming out with that video chat, then I'll be absent. I'll miss those ones.
It's okay. Just
away.
Say, I don't have a working webcam. I'm sorry. You'll just have to use this picture.
We can do an animated avatar. We'll do an animated avatar for you. It'll be no problem.
There we go.
I could just imagine.
Get one,
that'd
of those,
be great.
One of those silly screens that shows a cat talking whenever you.
We'll have some 8-foot tall IEL avatar for you. You know.
When I was on Skype, my kids and I we lit Hanukkah candles tonight via Skype because they're back in Boston. I'm here in New York, so we did the Skype thing together tonight. And my younger daughter had her Mona Lisa avatar on. So she's moving around, and you can see her eyes and her mouth move, but the whole face is the Mona Lisa. It was absolutely hysterical.
Wow.
That's
weird.
That just sounds kind of creepy, actually.
Mona Lisa is talking to me! Stop!
I didn't know she was Jewish.
It was very funny.
Oh, God.
So I don't remember that we've talked about, maybe we have, the Golem connection, speaking about Judaism and Hanukkah and all of that. Did we ever discuss the Golem connection with the Jewish mystical Golem?
No, I don't think that's ever really come up, other than in
the
absolutely very minor passing.
Say again, Spencer?
The Golem isn't a creature that we've talked about in depth. Well, no, Shadow Spawn, really, have we sat down and tried to dissect, you know, the influences of, except Narg.
Yeah.
We talk about Narg all the time.
I think if we talked about Gollum, it was mostly...
And his widow.
Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know his widow's name.
Yeah. Most of the time when we talk about possible influences for the Gollum, it's Gollum, actually.
Yeah.
Gollum. I can't do it.
I can't do it, especially right now with my... I should be able to do it good with the way my voice is right now, but
you really
you think.
But there is, you know, there is a Jewish mystical figure called a golem, which is created out of clay and brought to life, and it sort of serves as an earlier precursor to the Frankenstein story in some ways.
That's right.
Met and Ahmet.
You know, he takes.
Looks like someone watched his NCIS this week.
Actually,
so much from religion, so you never know, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the thing about the traditional story, if I remember properly, is that originally the golem is brought to life as a protector.
Right.
And it is merely later, and I saw a play, I want to say probably close to 12 or 15 years ago now, about it, which was really, really well done. And the guy they had to actually play the golem was rather brilliant. I wish I could remember the name of the play now, because it would be really great to reference. But yeah, it seems to me that the Shadow Spawn has a distinctly opposite purpose of the rabbinical golem.
Well, except that the golem becomes, as it grows, more increasingly violent.
Yes.
And it gets out of
true.
Control.
Well, Adam Kane started out to be a good guy, not really a protector, but he didn't start out as a villain. It was a little foreshadowing, but...
No, the best villains are the ones that are trying to do it to protect people. I mean, look at iRobot and other such things where, you know, in an effort to protect and preserve, they turn kind of villainous.
I never thought I'd see the Three Laws work its way into the Wheel of Time series.
Well, I got to do you one even better.
Okay.
We've gotten off topic again, you know, obviously.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. And
wow!
I was going to take us into another book series.
I'd love
to do that. Yeah, it's amazing. But no, the direction of this podcast, you know, reminds me of the car in Cat in the Hat. You know, once you get the three steering wheels out and you have three different people trying to drive it all in different directions, just start going around in a circle.
See, okay, I had a couple of different thoughts there as you variously qualified your sentences with more sentences. At first, I thought you were going to say the direction of this podcast is much like the Poseidon or the Titanic.
Oh no!
And then
I'm sinking.
Oh no!
And then following that, you said car. Without, like, with a significant pause before you actually said, as in, you know, the Cat in the Hat. And so I'm immediately thinking car, the evil car from...
Christine.
From Knight Rider.
Oh, no.
Which is its one phrase as it falls off the cliff and somehow gets destroyed even though it's an indestructible car.
You know what the Wheel of Time really lacks more than anything? Skynet. You know, that would really just cap it off.
No.
Who knows?
Well,
now those steam wagons are alive. Oh, no.
No,
it
might seem, Andrew, like I am able to greatly pause for effect. In fact, it's just me trying to figure out what the heck I'm going to say next because I have no freaking clue. I just start talking.
All right. Well, I think it's probably time to wrap up whatever this was.
Yeah, wrap it up with this episode is so going to be called Plague of the Podcasters.
So I just want to be clear that I don't want this episode to edit now.
Aww,
you know, in a serious vein, I never like editing the ones that I'm in. I notice that they tend to be a little bit longer because when I'm in them, I like to just leap stuff in because it's so much fun. So I have a tendency to give those to someone else to edit. So that
there you go.
Because then I know that they'll just cut the stuff that needs cut. They won't cut the things that are like, well, I sound stupid there, so I'm going to cut it. But this is really fun, and I enjoy this part, so I'm going to leave it in, even if it's like, you know, a 20-minute discussion of G.I. Joe or something.
Yeah, I know. That one probably... I'm going to make one last final stab at trying to pretend like I'm a producer. Do we have any final thoughts on Matt and the Tower of Genjai? We barely even mentioned Moraine.
Oh, is that what we were
like
talking
about?
She
wasn't even
today?
There. Yeah. Well, it's like Moraine wasn't even there. She was incidental to the whole to the whole visit.
It kind of was in the writing. Yeah.
there are so many other things to discuss about this.
The little hints about Lanphier being burned out faster.
Yeah.
And what that means. I mean, I think there's some interesting pieces around sort of Moraine and Stasis and what that carries forth and why was she being drawn out more slowly.
Oh, for their extended pleasure, I'm sure. They just wanted to make it last a little longer.
And was Lanphier the candy that they had to consume quickly?
Well, they may have, who knows how many Aes Sedai they've actually trapped like that. They may have not realized that they would, kill or burn her out. I think they said kill, actually, by drawing too much too quickly. They may have just made a mistake.
Yeah,
and then decided not to repeat that with Moraine, because, if they're gone, they're gone. Apparently they can't bring them back to life.
Well, yeah, the other thing is assuming, we know that Lanphier knew some more than necessarily most people would have, because I'm guessing the world of the Finns had to have been one of those things that was studied at some point in time by the people in the Age of Legends. We know that Moraine, we know that Lanphier was pretty high up in the studier of things like alternate worlds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems plausible to me, yeah, that she, knowing that they could possibly do this, and knowing also that should she die, more than likely the Dark One would transmigrate her soul, she may have just said, I want you to kill me quickly, as one of her, wishes.
Well, do you get it?
But maybe stipulating that...
Oh, yeah, you do. That's right. Never mind. Sorry.
But, I mean, she could have stipulated that, but leave me the ability to channel.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know. It seemed to me a little... To me, it seemed like they tried to use her up too quickly, and so she ended up dying. It's kind of the way that it read to me from what Moraine said.
True.
Although it could have been that they used her almost up, because that doesn't make sense. She had to have died. At some point in time, she had to have died.
Yeah. No, that's what she said, although she did say they might have just been telling her that to scare her more. But here's something else. Moraine herself said that questions touching the shadow can have dire consequences in the land of the Fen. Well, what does dropping a whole Forsaken in there do? I mean, bound to the shadow.
The thing is, my biggest question is, was Lanphier killed before or after Moradin came and fetched her? Because
it would
make sense for it to be after, because why would he come and get her body before? There's no reason to. Because if her soul is gone, then...
We don't know that it was Moradin that came and got her. Who was the man that Moraine said that she remembered coming and saying, you're not the one I want? Was that Slayer? Because he could travel in and out of the tower.
I don't think he can.
Maybe it was Moraine.
Maybe it was.
It's pretty well... Well, it's not pretty well. To me, it's kind of obvious that that's Moraine. But then I've often been wrong.
How does Moraine get a free pass to go in and out of there? With impunity.
I have no idea.
I mean,
because he's the hand of the Dark One, basically. He and Shadon Haran are the Dark One incarnate.
What do the Finns care about that?
He's the Dark One for all worlds, isn't he?
I don't know. I mean, Lanphier is one of the Forsaken. She should have had some sort of authority or power there, too, but she didn't.
She's not
Nablis.
Never been Nablis.
I don't think that Nablis has that much more power over the Finn than another Forsaken would. I mean, Nablis is first among equals among the Forsaken, but I don't think he has that many extra powers. He just has more authority. I mean, he can channel
the
power, but...
Yeah, the two possibilities that I see are, one, the true power has some sway over them, and because he has almost free access, well, not even almost, because he has free access to the true power, they somehow respect him. The other possibility is that he's the one that came through the doorway in Tyr.
And destroyed
it probably on the way back. Although, how he would have gone through the one in Tyr and then been able to ask requests rather than ask for answers, I don't know.
Well, the thing is I kind of assumed that the person who came and got Lanfear was Slayer, because Moradin in the beginning of this book to Grandel mentions that Slayer is his, like his tool to
right.
use. And I'm just guessing
control,
that
he would just delegate.
I don't know. I know it's only one line of characterization, but still the one line that we get through Moraine's eyes, it doesn't seem like Slayer to me. It really seems like Moradin's character.
No, I don't know.
Which again begs the question.
All he said to her was that you're not the one I want. You know,
yes,
how is
but
that more Slayer?
It's
more
not
Moradin.
Just the way he said it, but kind of the way he acted too. But again, you know, it's just a line or maybe two of characterization. Those few lines to me spoke more of Moradin than a Slayer, and also I don't know what dual soul one body kind of freakazoid that Slayer is. What effect?
Freakazoid, you haven't heard that one.
Yeah. I don't know what effect the Land of the Fens would have on him.
Well, he travels back and forth through it. He goes in and out of the tower at will.
I don't think he does.
I think
the scene with Perrin, I think, is he's jumping towards the tower, you know, to get Perrin to go into it, and then he blinks away someplace else.
Well, Perrin didn't have any way to get into it.
Oh, he must have gone in the tower. This
no,
is
I
before Perrin knows how to smell him.
I think Slayer has an in with the fin. All right. Well, I don't even think we've scratched the surface of this topic, even this small part of the Towers of Midnight, but we may have to come back and visit the Tower of Gendry and Moraine again. But for this episode, I think that will wrap it up. So I would like to thank everybody for showing up tonight. Daniel, Carrie, Andrew, Spencer, thank you all. It's been fun as usual, different and fun. Until the next episode, this is Virginia, hoping that the light illumine you until we meet again.
Take care, everybody.
This is Daniel saying courage to strength.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Domanshima, Taisha Day. The Fourth Age is
brought to you by DragonMath.com. To contact us, please visit our website, dragonmount.com/podcast.